Welcome to the Crazy Wisdom Podcast. Today I've got a very special episode that I've recorded with both my father and Rob Glazer. Rob Glazer is the CEO of Real Networks, and we got some really juicy details as it relates to the rise of the personal computing industry and how that got us to where we are today with the rise of the AI revolution. And one of the most interesting tidbits I got is that back, I believe it was in the 90s, Rob helped Microsoft kind of get the word processor and the spreadsheet market completely won by Microsoft Word. Before that, that was split between Lotus, Lotus Notes, and WordPerfect. Lotus being the spreadsheets that everybody was using, and WordPerfect being the word processor. And so Microsoft, on a CD-ROM, basically sent out both of these products, a word processor and a spreadsheet, into one CD-ROM that people had to pay for and capture that market. And that was before my time when I first started getting on a personal computer, which was with Microsoft Word. So that had already happened by the time that I had joined. So, you know, that's the point of this show, is that we're uncovering a lot of these sort of arcane details, but not without a purpose. The purpose is to understand the revolution of the personal computing industry, because that was like giant. And we're going through another one with AI, and apply those lessons to AI right now. So hope you enjoy this show. If you do enjoy the show, go ahead and subscribe on iTunes or Spotify. And I'll also start publishing a lot of these to YouTube as well. So find us Crazy Wisdom on iTunes or Spotify. Thank you so much. Welcome to the Crazy Wisdom Podcast. We are doing a special series called Stuart Squared, where both me and my dad interview people from his long-storied history as a journalist in the personal computing revolution. And today we have Rob Glazer, the CEO at Real Networks. Welcome to the show.
Great to meet you, Stuart, and great to see you again, Stuart.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to do a little bit of catch-up here. It turns out you mentioned before we started recording that you moved to Seattle in 1983, which was the same year I moved to Silicon Valley from Boston. And so we have kind of a marker there that gives us a shared history. So I want to talk about Real Networks, but I remember, and this is the issue, of course, as you get older, is do you really remember? So let's see if you can, if you remember, sitting in a hallway at Condex, 1984. 86, 87, something like that. And I think you were telling me how an operating system is designed. Do you remember this at all?
Well, I definitely met you in the mid 80s, and I'd have to guess when. I was at Microsoft from 83 to 93. So it was my first decade of my professional career. And we met during that period of time. I'm trying to remember now, when did you start your conference? What was your
conference? Was 87. Newsletter was 85. Yeah. And did you get involved with the CD-ROM conference?
Yeah, I did CD-ROM stuff at Microsoft for a little while, around 86, and then got more involved in the successor to that, or multimedia, in 89. So my arc at Microsoft was, I spent my first 4 years from 83 to 87 working on applications. Probably the best thing that I did commercially at that point was relaunch Microsoft Word, which kind of stumbled out of the gates, and helped get it to, in those early years, a very strong number two behind WordPerfect. So we didn't beat WordPerfect in the DOS era. We beat them in Windows. But in that period of time, it was considered to be significant at Microsoft to have a leading PC application, because Microsoft's spreadsheet.
Yeah, I have to interrupt you there, Rob.
That's what I was doing.
Microsoft Word, part of the way that Microsoft Word won was that it was considered really fast. Open the app, start writing, everything is available. That doesn't seem to matter anymore, because Microsoft Word is a pig.
When we marketed it, the thing we did that worked well, originally when Microsoft Word came out, it was bundled with a mouse. And the theory was that that was going to help people be productive. But people didn't, typists at the time didn't think that mice were anything other than a gimmick. Like, why would I want to take my hand off the keyboard? I type 80 words a minute. Why don't I move my hand? So I remember saying, when they got me involved with Word in 84, saying to Bill Gates and John Shirley, the then president of Microsoft, hey, I want to change this up. Instead of marketing Word as being the first word processor to work well with a mouse, let's market it as the first word processor to work really well with a laser printer, because the Apple Laser Writer and HP Laser had just come out, and they were phenomenal products. And Word, because of the genius of Charles Simonyi and the its heritage around coming out of the Xerox PARC era, understood typography deeply, and you could make really beautiful documents fast connected to laser printers. And that was a that was the right decision to go in that direction. But I remember Bill and John said to me, "Well, what are you going to do? We've got $1 million of mice in inventory." And I said to them, "Well, do you want me to solve your word processing market share problem or your mouse inventory problem? Because I can't do both." And I was kind of an impudent, whatever, 22-year-old at the time. And fortunately, Microsoft culture was when you spoke the truth and you had good arguments around it, you could carry the day, and particularly if you did it in a kind of a sharp, edgy way like that. So they said, OK, fine, you can refocus the business around laser printers. And that was the thing that drove us to leadership, a little bit behind WordPerfect at the time, but ultimately it led to a big success.
So you said particularly when you bundled and became a monopoly.
That was later. I was involved in the.
You weren't responsible for that, yeah.
Well, I know. Obviously, the whole tactic of Microsoft Office. I mean, it was Bill's idea, and it was whatever you want to say about the competitive dynamics. It was brilliant. It was a great pincer move. Microsoft had one of the two best word processors, Microsoft Word, and one of the two best spreadsheets, Microsoft Excel. And the competitors were divided. It was WordPerfect and Word Processing and Lotus and Spreadsheets. Mm. So by doing a good integration of those two products, bundling them together and redefining the product as Microsoft Office, it was a pincer move where neither WordPerfect nor Lotus could really compete effectively. They tried, you know, WordPerfect did some deal with Borland. Lotus bought a mediocre word processor called a Mi Pro. But ultimately, you know, after a year or two of the ascent of Windows 3.0, it was pretty clear that Office was going to dominate and become one of the sort of the twin towers of that era, where you had both Windows and Office reinforcing each other as powerful market drivers.
And that was until Google Docs?
Well, it still is the case. I mean, if you look at how much money Microsoft makes from Office, I mean, it's a huge phenomenon. It is the case that a lot of people use Google Docs, and Google derives a lot of market position from that. But in terms of revenue, I think Office still dominates enterprises.
Revenue, yeah, interesting. Dad, did you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, so you left Microsoft in 93, and I'm doing the math, and that means you've been CEO of Real Networks for 32 years?
A little over 30 years. I took about 3 years off in the early 2010s. So from 2010, 2011, most of 2012, I wasn't running the company. I've been back now a dozen years, plus or minus, and ran it for whatever, 15, 16 years before that. So I've had two good runs, and it's been a lot of fun, and I feel incredibly lucky.
Yeah. And this is the reason we ended up talking a lot, because I like to focus on media and, you know, whatever the hell you call it. And it's much different now. But part of the reason you left Microsoft is because you felt like you could do a better job, right? You did.
It was a combination. My dad had a small business. My dad had a small printing business and he ran it called Flair Printing in New York. He ran it for 30 years. So I grew up sort of seeing what it's like to be an entrepreneur, you know, kind of things get in your blood a little bit like that. It was never a very big business, never had more than like maybe five employees, but it was really interesting to see sort of how he did things and kind of learned by osmosis. So when I joined Microsoft, I kind of didn't have an intention of being there for 10 years, so I didn't have a specific plan. I thought, well, I'm going to do this until it gets boring, and maybe I'll start my own thing at some point. And I learned an incredible amount. You know, Gates is obviously an amazing entrepreneur, a huge collection of brilliant, hardcore people there who I learned a lot from. And I had a lot of fun. When it got to about 10 years in, I remember thinking, well, at some point, something becomes what you're doing with your life unless you change direction. And so I had an idea I had two ideas, one of which worked out great, one of which ended up not working out. And it's kind of always good to have a few different paths. And I thought, well, I'm really interested in the convergence of digital media and computing. And I'm curious how it's going to play out. And there's no way I can figure that out while I'm working 70 hours a week inside Microsoft. So in the spring of 93, there was a reorg planned, and Bill mentioned it to me and I worked directly for Bill, but at this point I was working for a great guy called Paul Moritz. And Paul mentioned to me, and I said to Paul, I said, hey, that's great. Let's organize me out of a job. And then I had three meetings with Bill in the spring of 93. He took it very personally, which, you know, I understand that as a founder, when someone you work closely with for at that point nearly a decade says they want to leave, you feel very personal about it. So we had a couple meetings where the first meeting, he got very upset and, you know, was pretty emotional. And he said, can you talk to this person? Can you talk to that person? And I did that. And then we had a second meeting. And in the second meeting, it kind of went a similar way. Can you talk to this person again? Can you talk to this other person? So I did that. And then we had a third meeting, and the third meeting was going the same way. And I said to Bill, it's a true story. I said, Bill, is this making you feel better? He looked at me like I was nuts. And I said, because if it's making you feel better, you should keep doing it. But it's not making me feel better. It's not changing my mind. To his credit, and Bill and I have since reconnected, and I consider him a good friend, and obviously he was a huge mentor to me over many years. He calmly switched gears, and we ended up having a rational conversation about, okay, you want to take a break, you want to step away. So officially I did it as a leave of absence for a couple months, came back, consulted with Bill on a few things, primarily what the future of the internet was and how Microsoft should adapt its strategy to the internet. And then I ended up creating what became Real Networks starting in early 94.
Not totally positive, but I feel like you ended up competing with Microsoft, right?
Exactly. Well, not because we wanted to. So the arc of that was the following. So when we came out with Real Audio and the Real Player in 95, we actually integrated it with the two leading web browsers, which at the time was Netscape and Internet Explorer. And so we tried to be Switzerland between the two browsers. We did browser integration with both of them. We were the first streaming media player for either of them. Through that, you know, ramped up very, very, very fast, and got off to a great start. Launched in April of 95, it was completely perfect coincidence of a really good technology, the exact right market timing, and we had some great partners that helped us provide content that worked with our technology very well to create a hand in glove, like, you know, something where consumers would actually want to use this stuff. So, go ahead.
What was the technical challenges of developing streaming media players in 95? What were like the big things that's prevented everybody from doing that before?
A few things, I would say bandwidth, which is modems point exactly. Bandwidth, the dominant modems there were 14.4 kilobit modems, and then 28.8 modems, which were twice the speed, were just coming online, and nobody had broadband. I mean, broadband was like this experiment that was being done. You know, Time Warner had one in Florida. There were a couple other little pockets, Castro Valley, California, et cetera, but nothing at any scale at that point. So you had to get something to work. And our chief insight and breakthrough was a combination of a technical one, which was streaming itself. We actually created our initial streaming protocols that worked on low bit rate. And the second was a commercial one, which we started with audio, because everyone was trying to do streaming video over modems, and it just looked like, you know, bad pop art. Like, you couldn't really see anything. So we were like, all right, well, let's nail audio. And even more narrow than that, let's nail voice audio, because at 14.4, music sounds terrible. 28.8, kind of make it sound okay. 56K, you can make it sound decent. But we thought, okay, let's focus on voice content, where what people want is the immediacy and the semantic value, not necessarily the aesthetic value. So it was those sort of combination of some really good technology to make streaming work from a functional standpoint, and then the content choices of media that worked adequately and in some ways compellingly over dial-up modems. And then we parlayed that. We didn't launch our video product, Real Video, until 97. At that point, broadband was just starting to kick in. We were still early for broadband, but it was clear broadband was coming by then, and we knew we had to be, you know,
sort of the beginning of ISDN. But
Exactly.
I invested in a company that was based on your technology, the audio streaming, because and you knew this at the time. It was not clear we would be a partner or competitor. That radio stations were in a world of hurt. They were really the first media business to be impacted because audio is easier to stream than video. And so people started listening to things on the internet, not listening to radio stations, and their whole business was based on advertising. So I've invested in a company called Highwire that figured out how to replace the ads in the broadcast with internet ads so that they could develop a new revenue stream. And didn't work. That's a whole other story because Clear Channel basically put us out of business, and now they're out of business. So.
Well, there was definitely the phenomenon where the rights holders, the incumbents in that business, the record companies, a lot of the big radio groups, tried to stop this technology from happening, ultimately to their detriment. But there were some other startup companies that hit the wall associated with that, and so it's tricky to navigate. We had the advantage that because we were a technology, it could be used for many different use cases. The ones that were more open to it, like we got news people like National Public Radio embraced our technology early on. We did a big partnership with ABC News, which was before Disney owned them, and they were pretty freewheeling and open-minded at the time. So it was we were able to find partners who embraced the technology and didn't fight it, but there were also pockets like the big radio groups, like the record companies that did fight it, and companies that focused on those businesses only had harder times.
Was that through lawsuits?
Well, there were a lot of lawsuits. We never crossed over in the side of piracy. I mean, so we were super focused on legitimate license use of stuff, and so we would license our technology to people, and I'm sure there are people who licensed our product who kind of colored outside the lines. Probably the most famous one was Mark Cuban, who started a company called AudioNet based on our product. And Mark played a little loose, as a kind of a wildcat entrepreneur. He would go to universities and say, "Hey, I want to stream your college sporting events. Will you let me do it?" And if he got an athletic director to say yes on a napkin, he would start doing it. So, Mark created a good network. He was a clever guy. He got police scanner stuff that was popular that he put up because it's public airwaves. You can kind of get the police scanner. So
Did AudioNet become broadcast.com?
and then when he went public, he rechanged the name from AudioNet to broadcast.com. Exactly.
Yeah. And then Yahoo bought it
Exactly.
and set him on his way.
Yes.
Let's see, I'm going back at it's very interesting to see in exactly the anecdote you're talking about, where legacy companies get challenged by digital technology, and they fight it tooth and nail. That certainly happened, with the music companies. Ultimately, when Napster showed up, and by the way, I always thought Napster had the wrong architecture and couldn't work anyway. But that's a different issue. But then you get into video and what's happened over the last, since Netflix showed up, that the studios are now feeling exactly the same hurt. And is it the same thing?
So it's been interesting which businesses have struggled, which ones have thrived, and which ones have pivoted. I mean, if you look at the music industry, the music industry itself, the now three major labels are doing very well, but they have two huge distributors, Apple and Spotify, and there's kind of this almost like a death cage match situation between them, where they are so much. I mean, the three of those companies collectively are probably 75% of the recorded music in the United States and most other markets. So if you don't have one of those three majors, you don't have a complete service. On the other hand, if Apple or Spotify were to ever stop paying them money, they represent so much of their revenue at this point that it would be a death knell. So there's kind of this cage match between the two of them. We spent some time in that business. We started a joint venture. When I talk about the rights holders, we started a joint venture with three of the labels called MusicNet, and then realized that that was just so inefficient. It was sort of like, trying to, run a business with the United Nations as your board of directors.
Yeah, exactly.
And, we literally, like, we'd have board meetings and lawyers would shuttle in and shuttle out depending on what they thought the antitrust implications were. The labels, even though they were stakeholders in MusicNet, they didn't do a great job of clearing their content for a bunch of reasons. So we pivoted out of that and bought a little company called Rhapsody that had gotten labeled licenses to the, they're the first company to get all, at that point, all five major labels to license them. And we scaled that up to, a couple million subscribers. But we never really got it to break out because of the combination of how the rights holders worked in terms of being restricted in what they were let us do. And also the fact that the way to play the game turned out to be in a quirky way. Either you had to be a huge incumbent like Apple, which kind of that happens in a lot of these businesses where the leaders in one business roll the tanks and they just, they lose a bunch of money, but they get market position that ultimately is very valuable. And you can even put YouTube in that same category, although they're more, more based on ad model, but there's a heck of a lot of music that streams over YouTube and all the music videos, et cetera. Or Spotify was the exception. And Spotify, this guy Daniel Ek is a great entrepreneur, super smart guy, good guy. He benefited the fact that in Europe, the streaming industry was basically stillborn because the rights holders were very conservative in general. And whether if we could get a million subscribers across Europe, across the US, in Europe, where every country, like in France, 60% of the repertoire is French repertoire, in Germany, 50, 60% is German repertoire, et cetera. So you have to license the content in each country, and it's incredibly expensive to do so. They wanted big advances, so nobody could figure out how to do that. So Daniel created a free product in Sweden and the UK that was much better than the free products that we could license in the US. And he offered he raised some money because he'd had a previous company that that he'd sold, so he had some capital from that. And he put down, I think, originally $10 million to get good licenses in Europe that were far better than any license that were available in the US. And he built up a very successful product that had a really good free product and an upsell to a premium product. And the upsell wasn't working that well, but you could squint and see how it might get there. Anyway, he built that product up in Europe. He was the king of Europe. And then he held out to go into the US until he could get basically equivalent rights in the US. The
Interesting.
dowry he had to pay for those rights was $100 million. And
Understand.
so Rhapsody at the time didn't have $100 million burning a hole in our pocket. But what Daniel was able to do was he was able to leverage the momentum in Europe to get a $1 billion valuation. So he sold 10% of his company, raised $100 million, turned around, licensed that, paid the license fees to the labels, and got
Yeah.
his good enough product on the free basis launched in the US. So kudos to Daniel for the stubbornness to not launch a watered-down product in the US, cleverness to be able to raise enough capital at a non-dilutive valuation to actually put the money in the record company's hands, and then to get those deals done and then get the ball rolling downhill. So that's sort of that was how that market worked. And independents like Rhapsody, we later merged with Napster, ironically, Stuart, we were able to eke out an okay living, but we ended up selling that business in 2019, I think it was,
Wow.
because it was just clear that it was going to be very hard to scale it. And so we kind of took an okay outcome. And so we haven't been in the digital music business for the last four years or so.
So I invested in the other company, originally called Full Audio and ultimately called Music Now. And the irony of that is we didn't make any money on it, but the irony of that is it got sold to Circuit City. And you think back and you go like, Stuart's going like Circuit City? What the hell's that?
No, I remember it, but I haven't heard about it for 10
Well,
years.
that's fine. So we actually bought Napster when we were Rhapsody. We bought it from Best Buy. Best Buy had bought
That's
Napster
right.
to be the basis of their digital music play because they were a huge distributor of physical music, but they had a very hard time making that transition work. All the legacy physical retailers, Blockbuster, Circuit City, Best Buy, had a very hard time. Best Buy still exists as a digital, as a physical electronics business, not completely gone, but their music, physical music business is tiny now because, CDs are, it's just hipsters buying vinyl pretty much nowadays.
Yeah, it's pretty old people.
So, yeah.
So what is Real Networks now, 30 years later?
So, the most recent transformation of Real was After 23 years of public company, we took it private at the end of 2022. And the reason for that, as I said, we sold the Rhapsody and Napster business. We'd sold a few other businesses, and the remaining businesses we had were in round numbers of $50 million of revenue in the three or four sectors, promising growth opportunities, but very diverse. And it didn't really make sense as a public company anymore. So I made a proposal to the board in this middle of 2022 to take the company private, got that done at the end of that year. And so for the last year and a little bit, we've been running as a kind of a fun entrepreneurial private group that's in four sectors. We have a games business called Game House, which is run by a phenomenal entrepreneur named Simonetta Lully. She's based in Barcelona. That's where the team is primarily based, in Barcelona and the Netherlands, and focused on great games for women. They're a darling of Apple. Tim Cook actually came to our offices. You know, the games are great. They're socially positive. They're fun. So we've had a nice, decent size and growing business there, focused on casual games, primarily for women. Then we have a business based, we have two AI businesses, mm-hmm. you know, and I know Stuart, through you talked about not AI not being the dominant part of this podcast, but AI is so central to everything. We had some proprietary data coming out of two of our businesses, one of the business that became known as Safer, where we had products and partners that used our streaming products for personal photos, a product called Real Times. And through that product, we had customers, millions of customers on six continents that were using our product. And as part of the terms of licenses, because it was often a free product, we got the ability to train models anonymously with that. We trained a phenomenal computer vision model around facial recognition and used that as a basis for this product called Safer, SAFR. And we focused it, as the name might suggest, on markets around physical security, access control, and the like, and are building up a pretty exciting business focused on doing that. And it's tricky because, you know, computer vision is such a good thing and it's so powerful, but it can also be used for things that aren't so good. Yeah. So we're really focused on best practices around how do you have informed consent? How do you have opting out if it's, you know, depending on the use case? You know, access control is an easy one because when you go work at a company, everyone knows your face, everyone knows your name because you're an employee there. So in use case like access control, you know, the ability to, you know, sort of to opt into it is intrinsic when you opt into being an employee of that company. So use case like that is super easy. The other use cases, one of our biggest customers in this business is a UK company called FaceWatch, which has created a really rigorous, really practice and system around preventing shoplifting and generally loss prevention in the UK. And they actually got the UK privacy regulator to say, the way they handle the data, the way they, some of it's our technology, like Bluey encrypted, et cetera, but also their data practices around not keeping the data for a particularly long time, having it be geo-fenced. So like if you're a thief in Leeds, you're not in the database, the London database, you're just in the Leeds database. And so FaceWatch is doing a phenomenal job in the UK, and there may be opportunities to take that approach globally, because as we know, loss prevention in theft in general, organized theft, has become a problem all around the world. So there's got to be a way, because, you know, think about it from the standpoint of the employee. You work in a store and people are coming in and there are groups of people are coming in and stealing stuff and overwhelming you. That's a lousy work experience for the employee. Think of it as a legitimate customer. You show up there and half the products are in cages and you got to hit a buzzer to get them out of the cage. That's a lousy experience. So how do we make physical retailing safe and sane for people in a way that's privacy sensitive? And the FaceWatch guys are a great partner that have figured out how to do that within the context of UK commercial culture and regulatory environment. You know, we're looking at ways to do that in the US. So that's our Safer business. That's our second business. We have another AI business in messaging called Context. We have another product that we acquired many years ago that we run called Metcalf, named as an homage to Bob Metcalf and Metcalf's Law, but Bob had nothing to do with it. They spell it differently. But Context is a layer on top of that. Metcalf sees over 1 billion messages a day, and we've trained the models based on that data to detect spam, smishing, phishing, nice. all this pernicious stuff. And we block over a million messages a day that would otherwise be preying on people to, you know, manipulate them with false URLs or other schemes to get them to, you know, to into scams. And so we have that business, our messaging business, we call it, but context is the sort of the crown jewel of that in AI. And then our fourth group is a bunch of our sort of legacy or historical businesses, and includes our the real player is still a valuable product used by millions of people. Our streaming technology is licensed primarily in Asia, actually. Those markets have stayed pretty strong for that. And so we have a couple of legacy or foundation businesses that we run as a group, and often are using those businesses to create spin outs like what we've done with Context and Safer. And that's my day job, is I running this private group. My goal is to kick myself upstairs to a full-time chairman over the next few years as these businesses become more independent. But we're in the early phases of that.
So I've got a great question about that. So the private versus public company distinction, I think I actually asked my dad this a couple of weeks ago, but like, why, what are the benefits of having a private company versus having a public company? And what are the drawbacks to both of those as well?
Well, so when we went public, in 97, so we were public for 25 years, basically, it was a great time for us to go public. We had a very clear business. We had a good story to tell. We could raise capital and on terms that were favorable. There weren't the same kinds of opportunities to get liquidity for employees and early investors that there are now. So going public or selling your company were the two primary ways you could get liquidity. So, and it served us very well for a long time to be a public company. Towards the end, it didn't serve us that well, really, for three reasons. One, as we sold businesses off, the overhead of being a public company started to become a meaningful part of it. So we could, we were spending a bunch of money on, like, you know, D&O insurance and, you know, legal compliance and like, you know, and if you're a $500 million business, which at one point we were before we sold a bunch of pieces off, those costs are, you know, whatever, the single digit million dollars a year. You know, they're not too exacting. When you're a $50 million business, as we were around the time that the remaining pieces were there, it's just too much overhead. The third reason is that when we were as a public company in one business, the market understood us, but being in four different businesses, people didn't understand us. So you kind of get a tax or discount on being that diverse set of businesses. And the last advantage is, at this point forward, we can do any deals we want that make sense to us, even if the first one quarter or two quarters optics aren't great. You know, we understand that. We understand the economics of what we're doing. We don't have to explain it to the financial markets. We can be more creative. I can, you know, give meaningful chunks of equity to the operators of these businesses to encourage them and their teams to be more entrepreneurial. So it seems like the right thing for us to do at this phase of the company. You know, who knows, one or two of the businesses, if they scale up, we might put them into a public company on their own. We might merge them into a public company on their own. So I'm not like religious that public is bad and private is good. It has to do with what phase of business you're in.
Yeah. So at some level, I feel like you're an enhanced version of your father. If he was at four or five employees, you have like several hundred, or whatever it is, you know, you're thinking about it in terms of being a business, as opposed to, you know, there's all this foo-for-all that comes with, you know, being a growth company and, you know, being on the leading edge of technology and doing all this stuff. But it sounds like you've kind of found a spot where you can run a company and buy and sell companies. And, you know, it's more like that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, that it's kind of gone full circle. My goal when we started Real was very aspirational, and you know, having achieved many of those aspirations at this stage of my life, you know, I like working, and I don't play golf. My tennis game is worse than mediocre. I love to travel, but I'm still in the phase of my life when I have, you know, my kids range from 6 to 17. I started having kids later in life. And so I'm kind of a, you know, still in a mode where I don't have like full independence, just like, you know, go anywhere and do anything. So working to me sort of fits the rhythm of my life. And I also think, and this may sound old fashioned, it's probably good for my kids to see their old man working and not just living life for leisure, because, you know, it confuses them. I had a conversation with my 17-year-old daughter. You know, she's got a car that's like a, you know, 3 or 4 year old Honda that she was driving around, and it was time for its scheduled maintenance. And she didn't want to take it for maintenance. She wanted my assistant to do it. And I said, no, Eva, you should do it. And she was, well, Dad, what's the last time you took your car in yourself? And I said, well, Eva, I took my car in every day of my life from the time I was a teen. When I first got my first car, I was 19. So when I was a teenager, 20s, 30s, into my 40s. And it was only when my life got more complicated that I had a good fortune of resource to have somebody help me do that. So you got to earn your stripes. But that's a much more credible story when she sees me working my tail off every day versus if I was just sitting on the beach, you know, 340 days a year.
My dad tried to teach me those lessons.
I'm resonating.
How'd that work out?
There's a lot of resistance, I would say.
You didn't bring your own car in?
So Rob, ask Stuart what his job is.
Well, what is your job, Stuart?
So at the moment, a consultant, AI enablement consultant, I was working in this field for the past year. And right now, what I'm getting paid for is doing facilitation of group conversations, but it is not yet a full-time job. And I just quit my full-time job. So I think that's what my dad is getting at.
They had a full-time job with a company called Invisible Technologies, which I love. It's the name. And there's a whole thing. We're not interviewing Stuart here. So that's a different thing.
My mom was a therapist, but it's not my profession either. So I can't help you out very much.
So when you went to Microsoft in 83, and I know this because I went to Silicon Valley, AI was a big deal. And, you know, there were venture-backed companies, mostly around Boston at the time, you know, and then there's been multiple generations. So talk about AI, what it means right now, and whether we got there and, you know, don't, you know, whatever, we're already there. Like, or is it more like Napster and then real networks? It's like, you know, what happens after this?
So I'm a huge believer in AI, as long as you're kind of intentional about what you're using it for. Interestingly enough, because when I did my undergrad degree in computer science, one of my thesis project was an old school AI expert system. And back at the time, this was way before the current wave of AI technology. The ways people were trying to build AI into machines was by hard coding specific knowledge in there, what we call expert systems. And there were a few use cases where they worked, but generally speaking, it was much too rigid and ad hoc and not coherent. It was not comprehensive. The thing that happened in the AI technology, and it was contemplated 40 years ago by some of the pioneers now, but there wasn't nearly enough computing power to do it. A lot of the algorithms that are necessary to do it hadn't been invented yet, is where the whole model of machine learning, which is you create a huge data set and you tag it in a way that allows it to be kind of understood to be, you know, what's ground truth is, like, you know, which two people are the same people versus different, you know, what's a grammatically correct sentence versus an incorrect sentence. And then the machine learns through a massive data set and creates its own model for what for how to interpret data. And that machine learning breakthrough, there's this phenomenal book called Genius Makers. It's not as famous as it should be, about a guy named Cade Metz, that describes the evolution of that history. And I commend it to anybody who wants to understand the evolution of how AI went from being a backwater in various ways to where core technology actually, you know, it works brilliantly when used for the right thing. The AI phenomenon that's happened over the last 2 years, and ChatGPT is the, you know, the sort of the crowning example of it, is the generative AI revolution, which is built on the same underlying techniques that the first set of machine learning technologies enabled. But in this case, it's based on massive data sets, like what they call large language models, where literally every piece of text you could ever scarf in, every encyclopedia entry, every document ever written that you can get your hands on. You use that to train the models. And then the models can be used not just to understand things like facial recognition or natural language processing, but to generate things, hence the name generative AI. Mm. And so the generative revolution builds on top of the previous revolutions, and it's the thing that's gotten so much hype. And I would say I'm generally bullish on the value it's going to create, but it's also clear that there's going to be a lot of glitches. I mean, by analogy, think about how hard it's been to get self-driving cars to actually work in the real world. And that's for a few reasons. One, there's all these special cases that don't work well. And two, we're very intolerant if a computer causes a car crash. You know, car safety is still a tricky issue. We've improved it, but tens of thousands of people, Americans a year, die in car crashes. But we don't blame computers for those. I mean, every once in a while, maybe there's a malfunction of a computing device in a car, but generally speaking, it's driving conditions, if mechanical thing breaks down, or operator error. Or operator error, including
which is operator error, but yeah.
Inebriated and not paying attention, distracted through texting, whatever. So we're highly intolerant when machines make mistakes on their own. So the test that self-driving cars are having to go through isn't just are they less dangerous than human drivers. It's do they almost never cause accidents on their own? And until you get that figured out, I think there's going to be resistance to switching over. Similarly with generative AI, you know, you have a lot of, you know, concerns of our students submitting term papers they didn't write. Yeah, I'm sure there's some of that, you know, but it's also, you know, it's an incredibly powerful way to automate or semi-automate things, but you got to be mindful of it. I think the next wave of generative AI, and working on some products in this field, is actually going to be to harness the power of generative AI with user interface and user experiences on top of them that actually make them useful for subsets of use cases, meaningful use cases. You know, people are trying to do this in medicine and diagnosis. People are trying law. To do this in law. You know, I think there's some consumer opportunities. Some of them, which actually we're looking at, that I think are pretty darn exciting. But so I'm fundamentally bullish on AI and this wave of AI. But there is a lot of hype, and there is a lot of sad stories of people that tried to build businesses based on this stuff, where ultimately it didn't work well enough, or it got, like in the case of self-driving cars, the social dynamics associated with its use are they create a blockage of people actually not wanting to use it. And then, of course, to your point about digital media, there are all the rights holders that are suing these folks, because it's not obvious that what OpenAI did and some of the others did is actually fair use. I mean, that's going to get litigated, and who knows how that's going to play out. That seems super murky to me.
So I wonder if it's generative AI, right? It's not AGI, which is like, you know, the Turing test and all that.
Yeah.
Is that going to happen, AGI?
Well, so a lot of the people who spend time in AI love reading science fiction. So I feel like a lot of the conversations about really dystopian outcomes come from people who have very fertile imaginations, which is a phenomenon, and they'll read a book about robots taking over the world, or they'll read a book about, you know, sorry, you know, 2000, I'm sorry, Hal, I can't open the pod bay door. I'm sorry, Gabe, I can't open the pod bay door, you know, and because Hal wants to take over the mission. I don't think it's likely that we're going to turn over control of, you know, fundamental things like missile guidance systems, or fundamental things like, you know, control over air traffic control to AI systems entirely. There is danger that we will take recommendations from them and not understand the risks of errors in those things, not necessarily because of intentionality, but just because these, you know, a lot of these machine learning systems are black boxes where nobody really understands what went on inside them. I think the bigger risk is despots. You know, like if you look at what happens with the Uyghurs in China, if you look at what's happening with disinformation, you know, coming from the Russians, Putin and like coming into the U.S. And that, to me, the bigger risk is how these tools are incredibly powerful when they are intentionally in the hands of people with with bad goals or bad intentions or bad values. So that's my biggest concern when I think about the risks of this. Not that the robots are going to take over because we stupidly put them in charge of the air traffic control system or put them in charge of, you know, the like in 2001 with the space mission. But because
I have to tell you, Rob, that I've been taking a riding Waymo when I'm in San Francisco. And
yeah.
They've done a really effing good job of, you know, it's the whole system and how they've designed it, which is remarkable to say about
why
Google.
Why do you prefer it to Uber other than it's fun and interesting?
Uber, because yeah. In Uber, you have a driver and you don't know who the hell it is. So Waymo is more reliable, right? I go off, start doing my email, and I work in a Waymo. And in Uber, I'm like focused on the driver because this guy doesn't speak English, and you know, Lord knows if he knows where he's going.
Yeah. So I have a question. I have a question for both of you. Have you either of you heard of the term solarpunk? I imagine both of you have heard of the term cyberpunk for sure. Science fiction, but never have you heard of solarpunk?
No, what's solarpunk?
So solarpunk is a theme similar to cyberpunk in the sense that cyberpunk is the very dystopian version of science fiction. In the 1960s, 1950s, science fiction was a very optimistic, utopian type of thing. And then all of a sudden, somewhere in the 1980s, I think it has something to do with nuclear power, basically cyberpunk took over, very dystopian. Solarpunk is actually a whole nother genre that I couldn't find any books. I think it's just a Burning Man camp. But it basically means like we're entering a sort of utopia. Imagine what solar panels could do. Imagine if we could harness the power of the sun. Imagine if we could harness the power of materials. What kind of awesome society we could create. And it's funny because there's no books about it except for this weird one in the 1970s that I found.
On Wikipedia though. And yeah. It's pretty interesting. It's sort of the opposite of cyberpunk.
Exactly.
It's like yeah. happy.
Well, I think these things go in waves. I mean, I think we're living in an era right now where there's a huge amount of dystopian fear.
Yes.
You know, not to narrowly focus on the political, but where in large parts of the world, including the U.S., the lack of there being any kind of, you know, newspaper of record, television channel of record, has created an opportunity for very cynical, craven people to essentially tell whatever version of the truth they want to tell that serves their own purposes. And that unmooring is very dangerous. Mm-hmm. But it's not obvious how you can put the toothpaste back in the tube. I mean, we're not going to go back to a three-network world. We're not going to go back to a world where 90% of the country, you know, gets the news from, you know, what a New York Times or a Washington Post says is the news. So how do you have fact-based analysis driving things that are knowable facts? And where it gets murky is like, let's take like the pandemic, which was a huge curveball. It was not knowable whether the pandemic came from a lab leak or came from a random mutation of farm animals at a wet farm. You know, today we don't know that. We know that the whole way the Chinese government handled that question was to try to cover things up, but maybe they covered it up because they were embarrassed about being the source of the initial COVID virus in the first place. You know, that's the we don't know why what their motivation was. They had many different motivations to not want to open it up to inspectors. It's all very murky. It was a mistake for any social media platform to say, "Hey, there's only one truth, and you can't debate that topic." At the same time, these vaccines, these amazing mRNA vaccines, saved millions of lives. And the conspiracy theory that they're injecting, you know, microchips into our bodies or something crazy like that, that's as factually false. So how do you have a system that allows you to debate things that should be open to debate? Like, where did it come from? You know, that's a complicated question. It's not obvious. Even all the expert reports say you can argue either way. To the fact that you can't argue that people are putting microchips in your body when they're giving you an mRNA vaccine, because that's not physically what's happening. There's no microchip in the serum. You know, there's no such technology as liquid microchips. Even if there were, it's not what's in the serum. And, you know, it's saved millions of lives. So how do you have a system that allows for that truth to be promoted and reinforced, and not blocking out legitimate debate on topics like where did the lab leak, where did it come from?
I think we might be moving into a system where there is no system. And actually, this goes back to a question I wanted to ask you earlier about, like, you've been in large companies with like thousands of people and stuff like that. My understanding is that we might be entering a world where that becomes a structural disadvantage. I'd love to hear what you think, whether because of AI, because the lack of coordination costs that are now coming around, that we'll soon be able to basically get a lot more work done with less and less coordination costs. Whereas you've been a company with large coordination costs. So I'd love to hear what you think.
Well, the data would seem to suggest that if you just took a snapshot today, the amount of market power that the Microsofts, Apples, Metas, Google/Alphabet, Amazons have, just those five companies, is so powerful. And they have such company-owned proprietary advantages for any new products and services they bring to market, that they have, even if they bring them to market inefficiently, even if they bring them to market slowly, even if they bring only okay versions of those products to market, they have such huge structural advantages. That doesn't mean that only those five companies get to exist, but I certainly don't think we're seeing those companies behave like dinosaurs. And so I would say that while there's cross currents, the dominant current seems to be that the huge network effect powers of these digital platforms allow behemoths to get even bigger and more powerful, absent regulatory or other counterbalances.
What do you think, Deb?
Yeah, more and more concentrated. It is true, right? Rob, all through your career, I'm sure you've heard of the long tail, which I think is one of the biggest bullshits ever perpetrated.
Wait, why?
Because people like to consume whatever they're consuming. It's media or thinking or anything like that. And, you know, it used to be that the long tail is, it used to be everybody had to do the same thing, right? So you had this big blob, but the internet would allow the long tail to get what they wanted because it would be individualist. And it's exactly what Rob's saying. I don't think this process has actually ever happened. And anybody who tried to kind of focus on the long tail realized it just wasn't that much business to be done there.
I think again, there's cross currents. I mean, there is so much diversity of information out there on the internet compared to what it was like when it was three TV networks and Prodigy and CompuServe. You know, I mean, there's so much information available, and if you're a gay kid growing up in a small town in Nebraska, you can access other people who are like you and connect with them in a way that you never could before the digital era. So that's a long tail. Gay isn't that rare, whatever, 10, 15% of the population, take your pick on the number. But if you're interested in a very specific genre of culture, you know, solar punk or whatever, you can find people in 20 minutes who also share your interest and your passion. So the long tail is still alive for sure, in my view. But what's happened is the economic dominance of these mega powers means that you're not looking on the open internet for them. I mean, if you are looking on Google, which is the closest thing to the open internet, Google's monetizing you through its long tail, ad program. Mm-hmm. So in a way that doesn't allow the guy who runs the equivalent of the indie comic store to have access to customers without paying for them. So I guess I would say long tail and monopolistic or oligopolistic market power are happening side by side. One is where the finances are. One is where the interest is. But if you have to be kind of, you know, focusing on things that are meaningful to you personally and trying to monetize that and create a living out of it can be much, much harder.
It's clear I was giving you a kind of venture capitalist response, which is, you know, in the long tail, there's no venture-backed business to be had.
I think that's probably never true.
Yeah. And I'm always interested. You wouldn't know this, Rob, from knowing me for a long time, but I actually am interested in making money. That it's a fun thing to do if you do it right, right? If you engage with entrepreneurs like yourself you know, do something new, it's like a lot of fun. And the result being you make money. So I am a capitalist. Stuart's oldest sister and my first daughter is a communist. And so it's a very interesting kind of generational thing that, you know, I'm a capitalist by title, and she became a communist, and she serves on the executive team at the teachers union in San Francisco, and recently won a 30% wage increase and was very happy with herself. And
I think generically teachers are underpaid in our society. So initiatives that might not be considered classically capitalist, I think, might make society a better place. But it's kind of, you know, it's a, I'm sure the dinner table conversations are between a venture communist and a venture capitalist are pretty interesting.
I was caught in the crossfire many times. We've come up with time. Thank you so much for coming on the show. How can people find out more about what you're doing with Real Networks?
Well, realnetworks.com is our website. We probably need to refurbish it to update a little bit more on some of the things I've shared with you today. But you can get to the various websites, the Safer website, the Context website, the Gamehouse website. And we're running each of those as pretty independent businesses. But realnetworks.com, and you know, it's I'm Rob G at real.com. I had email address I've had for 30 years. Get a lot of email from bots and other creatures. So if people email me, I may not get it right away, but it's always good to hear from people.
Cool. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Rob.
All right, great talk.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you learned something new about the rise of the personal computing industry, please go ahead and find us on Spotify, iTunes, or YouTube, and subscribe. And leave us a review if you really liked it, because the more reviews, the better. Thank you guys so much for tuning in, and have a great day.